lives his life in pieces. By God tier meme. Read by Sam Gabriel. Based on the works of Andrew Hussey. Winter 64, 2100. Your name is Rose Lalonde, and you have just learned that you have a twin brother. No, scratch that. You had a twin brother. He was born about 3 hours before you, around 2300, on Winter 63, 2065. Now, 35 years later, he lies, unequivocally dead, upon a metal examination table with the remnants of an unmistakable Y-shaped incision of a recent autopsy spanning his chest. In some ways, it seems impossible. He bears few physical similarities to you. His skin is sickly pale, even for someone who has apparently been dead for about a week. His hair is similarly desaturated, verging on white, but he has the same arched nasal bridge and freckle-dusted cheeks as you. His attached earlobes look like your mother's and, more importantly, your own. Most of his wounds, all of them methodically photographed and pinned to a nearby corkboard, have been cleaned up and covered to the best of the mortician's abilities, but the clear remnants of a gaping, through-and-through stab wound still rest at the near center of his abdomen. Bruises have been plastered over with makeup. Massive gashes across the front and back of his hands have been sutured and glazed over with a mix of pigment and wax. The same treatment has been applied to sharp-edged tears across his chest, back, and legs. His head has been tilted to the left in a well-meaning but ultimately meaningless attempt to hide the irreparable dent in his skull. The photos of the devastation, the before images, are just as harrowing as the corpse on the table. Muscle and bone formed tangled masses of flesh. Skin and sinew fell loosely around gaping wounds. His engagement ring must have been pulled with great force, his left ring finger, now covered in a sheath of cosmetic wax, was entirely degloved. Bright red muscle and blood-soaked, wilted flesh barely covered the appendage. But none of that really matters. It's his brain that you need. As a murder victim, the spongy mass that once powered his existence has been carefully preserved and placed inside an electroconductive jar. Aside from some understandable bruising and deformities on the left hemisphere, there's nothing remarkable about it. Considering the nature of his death, it's also unsurprising to see that not all of his brain made it out intact. The assorted bits of loose gray matter, presumably scraped from the crime scene and washed from fragments of bone, float freely in the suspension liquid. You collect the sum of your hitherto unknown twin brother's experiences with little fanfare and reassure yourself that this job is like any other. Yet, as you ride the auto taxi back to your office, you find yourself remembering old dreams. As a child, your mother often scolded you for speaking about your imaginary friend. His name was David. He was your age, and he talked like an old-fashioned cowboy. Until you were 7, you often pretended to play with this fictitious companion. Now, as you stare up at seemingly endless walls of concrete and glass that pass by the auto taxi's windows, you wonder if you somehow knew about your twin. No. No, of course not. After just a few seconds of pondering, you vehemently reject such a whimsical idea as mere coincidence. Instead, you unlock your tablet and review the case. You are New Alternia's foremost post-mortem psychologist, after all. And this job has been placed in your lap via explicit orders from the city's mayor, your twin brother's fiancée, Carcat Ventus. According to the notes provided by Carcat, David spent most of his life in Houston, Texas, under the dictatorial thumb of an overbearing father. He escaped at 15 years old, moved to New Alternia, and eventually met the man who would become the city's youngest mayor. 6 months ago, the two men were formally engaged. 3 weeks ago, Dave returns to Houston, much to Carcat's chagrin, to tell his father about his upcoming marriage. He was last heard from 18 days ago, and his body was discovered in a dumpster on Winter 58. Again and again, even as you exit the auto taxi and pay your fare, you reassure yourself. This is a normal job. This is a routine job. There's nothing here to fear. The words begin as a silent thought. Then you say them aloud, desperately hoping that doing so will make it all more tangible, more believable. You repeat the words aloud as you run through the usual steps to establish a post-mortem mind link. You place the brain atop a conductive copper platform and carefully situate it at the center. Using the provided clamps, you secure a pair of wires to the two nubby, antenna-like prongs that jut from opposite sides of the jar's lid. When you're satisfied with the setup, you flip the device's main power switch. You repeat the words. As the LED status lights turn green and as you sit in your luxurious recliner. "This is a normal job," you say, as you slip on the virtual reality interfacing device. The cold contact points rub against your scalp, dully buzzing with energy, and the familiar sensation offers the tiniest bit of relief. And every time you say those words, you know they're little more than cold, useless platitudes. Your uncertainty only solidifies when you hit the initiation switch beneath your right thumb. There's the slightest bit of resistance, a built-in safety mechanism, so they say, and it gives your heart just enough time to start pounding rudely in your ears. The Neuralink activates, prompting a familiar sensation akin to plunging into ice-cold water. And so begins the first, and presumably only, chat you will ever have with your twin brother. You're in what you recognize as the Mayoral Mansion, when warmth then sensation return to your nerves. Most people unconsciously choose their happiest memory for their final neural landscape. Dave, it seems, has chosen to relive his engagement party. If you recall correctly, news of the surprisingly intimate and fully private event broke just weeks ago. Images of him and Kark had adorned the shelves in almost every photo. They're laughing and smiling and looking almost sickeningly love-struck. A few snapshots show them facetiously fighting one another. Brightly colored decorations are in place, and a congratulatory banner spans the entryway. Unfortunately, the text is written in Alternian, and you can't figure out what it says. There's a red and gray three-tier cake resting on a central table, and wood logs power a warm, crackling fire in the main hearth. It's the perfect scene, something that seems tailor-made for the hopeful grooms. The only problem is the vast, cold emptiness of it all. Aside from you, the only other person here is Dave, dressed in a red suit and wearing a pair of reflective sunglasses. And the minute he notices you, his eyebrows form a near-solid line of confusion. His lips twitch downwards in the same way that your mother's do when she's mad. And when he speaks, his voice is marked by a distinctly southern drawl.
"Who the hell are you?"
he demands. Then after a moment of silence, he takes a step back and massages his thumbs against his temples.
"Hell. I remember you. I've seen your pictures. You're Rose, right? You're that sister my pa constantly ragged on."
His frown grows bigger.
"What are you doing at my engagement party? What the hell is everyone?"
You've never been particularly fond of breaking the news to your pseudo-clients. Few people want to be told they're dead. And even fewer want to be murder victims. Alas, this is part of your job. Dave is far from the first person to whom you've delivered this news, and he won't be the last. So with a practiced, calculated smile, you respond.
"Yes, I'm Rose Lalonde, post-mortem psychologist."
"Post-mortem,"
Dave mutters, carefully sounding out the word, and it clicks.
"Fuck, you mean I'm dead, right? What, I'm like really and truly fucking dead? This ain't a bad dream, huh? I'm really dead."
Where some people cry, he reacts with anger. He turns and topples a display of glassware before staring at you. The cacophonous burst of shattering glass hangs in the air, echoing for some time despite the room's lavish furnishings. Then suddenly, his jaw is set. He's accepted his fate. He breathes in, pinches his nose, and continues his tone, now uncannily even.
"You wanna know who did it, right? That's your job. All you fancy psychologist folks, that's what you do. You folks ought to crack me open and rummage around in my head like it's a free-for-all buffet.
In a sense, you say, folding your hands behind your back. I like to think of myself as more of a psychopomp, but you can call me whatever you please, and unfortunately you are dead.
Dave responds with a sigh. Distress is written plainly across his face, but he somehow maintains an otherwise cool demeanor. He folds his hands behind his head as he drops into a nearby armchair.
So what's the deal? Is it really that hard for the worthless buzz to tell you that my douchebag of a father killed me? I know they're incompetent as fuck, but there's gotta be a new goddamn low. Can't even catch a guy who's on record threatening to kill me at least a dozen times.
No, it's not that. Your father? Our father?
You correct yourself.
Is already in custody, but indeed my job is typically to extract relevant information about a case. You, Dave, are a bit different. Carcat has specifically contacted me to ask you some questions and build a larger case against your father. That said, it would be beneficial to investigators if you can corroborate how you died.
You want to know the play-by-play, just the basics?
Dave's lips twitch again. You see your mother's mannerisms in him when he wrings his hands together and stares at the floor. You hear a touch of her voice in his as he continues.
And I'll just go ahead and climb on the Assumption Express and say you need to know why it happened, right? Promise I had nothing to do with it. And if he's dead, it was purely self-defense. Believe it or not, I didn't have an ounce of anger when I showed up at his penthouse. All I wanted to do was tell him to leave me the fuck alone.
You nod and scribe Dave's words into your notebook. After many years of work, you've learned to envision your tools in the liminal realm of dying synapses. Doing so lessens that annoying, fuzzy feeling of disconnect you would otherwise get. You push for more info, asking, so what happened?
He attacked me.
Dave shrugs.
Said marrying a politician was a betrayal of my ideals and I'd, like, get you soft from it all.
Here he stops. He reaches into his breast pocket and takes out a pack of cigarettes. You recognize the dark, glossy packaging as Marlboro Premium Black. One gets stuffed into his mouth and lit with borderline frenzied energy before he continues.
I don't even remember what happened between that and the fight. The fucking point is that he hit first. It started with punches and kicks, then it veered directly into Blade Town. He stabbed me, and I'm pretty fucking understandably freaked out. I think he did too. Pulling the sword out made it worse, and I guess his fucked up brain went, holy fuck, I should mercy kill this kid. Last thing I remember is him caving in my skull with a tire iron.
You've heard plenty of violent tales before. You've witnessed murder scenes with floors so soaked with blood that you swore they were originally red. You've stood before excruciatingly detailed mental recreations of brutal homicides, but something about Dave's indifference pulls at an emotion you don't quite understand, and that pisses you off. It horrifies you. The vast infinity of uncertainty spreads before you, and it's the most terrifying thing you've ever seen. Meanwhile, Dave, blissfully unaware of your feelings, spins around and drapes his legs over the armrest. A plume of smoke rises from his lips as he starts a completely different discussion.
So I know I'm dead and all, but can you entertain some questions before I ride into the eternal sunset? I've always wanted to know how much my pa's bullshit was real.
I'm not a family therapist, and I would really prefer to keep my private life strictly separated from my job.
You push back, but it's a pitifully poor rebuttal. And you know it's a shitty excuse. You try again, more forcefully, as you say,
you're a client. Nothing more.
I'm your older brother, technically.
Infuriatingly, Dave's lips curl into a wry smirk, and each word is carried aloft on a puff of smoke.
Come on, Rose. I spent my whole life wondering what it'd be like to know my twin sister. Humor a dying man. Why don't you?
His honeyed tone reminds you of how your mother so often tried to soothe your fears when you were young. And for a reason you can't quite explain. Because of that horrifically unknown feeling that twists and writhes in your chest, the raw, wretched truth spills from your lips.
I didn't even know I had a twin brother. Mother rarely spoke of what happened before the divorce. When she did, she claimed you died in infancy. In all honesty, her stories were so discordant that I assumed them all to be fanciful lies, the illusory dreams of a lifelong alcoholic.
Dave's disappointment looks just like yours. He visibly deflates.
But you at least get to see that unbearable grin wiped off his face.
Dang harsh. But understandable.
I've gotten what I needed, you say, trying desperately to find a way to end the discussion. If you can shut this down and leave, you won't have to bother with this nagging, aching sensation. You won't have to ponder its implications, and you can resume your life without complaint. More importantly, you'll be able to shut down the simulation before Dave's brain runs out of energy, but Dave won't allow that, no. With just as much force and heartache, he pushes for answers.
Hey, if I'm gonna die, at the end of this, can I at least ask if anything my pa said was true? Like, I know he was a lying bastard. Everyone knew he was a lying, bitter bastard. He basically lost his fucking mind in the divorce. Everything he ever did just grew off of like a nasty, festering tumor, and I just want to know if any of it, even just the world's most pathetic goddamn scrap of it all, is true.
Really, Dave, I should really just shut down the interface before you begin. And you sound far too small. Again, he interrupts.
Just tell me if Mom gave me up, will you?
He asks. His tone rushed and panicked. His shades have slipped down, and you can see that his eyes are wide and watery. He wants to know this. He desperately, wildly wants to know the answer. And for all your talk of professionalism, you can't bring yourself to deny him that final luxury. Yes, you admit. Your voice strangely soft. Mother gave you away. It wasn't entirely her choice, though. Dirk's father kept demanding some sort of repayment, apparently. He said he'd leave us, Mother and I, alone if he got you, so she agreed. Dave blinks. The tension in his shoulders melts into resigned sadness. You feel as if you've said something wrong. You've told the truth, yes, you've said what he wanted, but you now feel as if you need to justify your lifetime of inaction. You clear your throat and tap your pen against your notepad as you speak, saying,
I spent all but the first year of my life in New York State. I assumed you were but a fanciful hallucination, a phantom born from Mother's alcoholism. If I had known you were real, that you were actually out there, I would have tried to contact you. Perhaps we could have helped.
For the next few minutes, Dave remains silent. He smokes his cigarette and lets it dwindle until the burning tip nearly touches his fingers. Then, with a long sigh, he tosses it to the floor. He spins around, stomps his foot down, and grinds the smoldering cigarette beneath the toe of his polished Oxford shoe. There's a spark of fondness and intrigue in his reddish eyes, then it fades.
Hey, before you go,
he says, and there's a sincerity in his voice that seems intensely uncharacteristic.
Can you tell Carcat that I'm sorry? I should have listened to the shouty bastard. If I had, we'd be getting married tomorrow. And Tom, I really, really wish I was here for that. I really did love him. You know, he was everything to me. He saved my stupid, reckless ass.
You nod. Normally, you're unfazed by such displays. You've been on the receiving end of countless final requests. You've been asked to deliver messages to friends, spouses, family, and children. None of them have hit you as hard as this, and that unknown feeling tightens around your chest.
I bet you would have been a cool sister too, Rose. I always wanted to meet you. So, hey.
Dave breathes a bitter, dejected laugh.
There's one plus. I finally got to be my twin.
Again, all you can do is nod. You know you need to end the simulation soon. If you don't, you'll only add to his suffering. You'll be forcing him to live out the last seconds of his existence as a digital ghost, but you can't bring yourself to hit that power button. Panic and longing mingle in Dave's voice.
Look, Rose. Dr. Lalonde, whatever. I'm glad I met you, truly, but I wish it wasn't like this. I was actually looking forward to living. The one fucking time I was happy, I had to blow it.
Another cold laugh gives way to rising, palpable panic
Clark Kent did always call me an insufferable, borderline, suicidal moron.
His form shifts and fades like a cheap film effect, then...
I don't want to die,
he mutters. And his final flashes of mental energy cling desperately to the situation. Suddenly he springs to his feet and grabs your shoulders. His touch feels like burning peg.
Don't let me die, Rose! I can't die, not now. Not when I finally have something to fucking live for. Not after I promised Car Cat I'd be back in time for the wedding. My suit's all set for tomorrow. I had it all planned out. John's coming down to be my best man. For fuck's sake, Rose!
He doesn't finish. Whatever energy is left running through Dave's mind collapses, as does his likeness, and he devotes the last traces of everything that he was, every memory and fear and heartache and joy, into speaking one last time, saying,
please, tell Kat I'm so, so fucking sorry. Don't let me waiting. If there's something, anything after this, I'll be waiting for
you. You rip off the headset and stumble to your feet. Your heart is racing. Your hands shake. You've always known about the time limit. The longer someone has been dead, the less energy their minds hold. A well-preserved brain, even one in as sorry a state as Dave's, can maintain a solid connection for about 20 minutes. You've always gone to great lengths to ensure clients never meet that limit. You've never wanted to make someone's last moments of life be the sort of raw, pure panic that you have just witnessed. Dave is the first time you've ever let things run their course, and you're now more determined than ever to make sure he's your last. After setting the visualizer and interface controls on your desk, you grab your trash bin and vomit. Winter 65, 2100. You've always had vivid dreams, but tonight feels different. No, tonight is different. It's different in the way a comedy can become a tragedy with a carefully placed line. You can feel it. The way the atmosphere of your unconscious mind shifts, you squeeze your eyes shut, and you find yourself somewhere else when you open them. You're in a grimy, run-down penthouse. Formerly opulent floor-to-ceiling windows are caked in dust and dirt. Broken bottles and crushed beer cans litter the floor, forming a minefield of debris. A voice shouts at you, and you dully recognize it as your father's. You have never met him before, not in person. You've only seen snapshots of the drunkard through grainy VHS tapes, long-forgotten memories that you, driven by childish curiosity and an unyielding need to know, found beneath some loose attic floorboards, but for some reason, despite knowing what he should look like, you can't see his face. Instead, you see a vague, dark blur. When you look down, you find that your hands are not your own. Your skin is too pale and scarred. You know what's happening. You've read about it in your studies. If you allow someone's mind to run its full course, you risk absorbing their final moments. You have, for all intents and purposes, become your twin brother, just for now, of course, and only until the dream ends. You find yourself taking note of some peculiarities. Your joints ache far more than they should. When you walk, your right knee grinds against itself and produces an unpleasant sensation akin to rubbing together bits of broken glass. Your vision is borderline useless. There's enough clarity for you to identify objects, but seeing fine details is downright impossible. A persistent ringing fills your left ear, and your roving tongue finds six empty slots where teeth should be. Before you can fully get your bearings, the hulking shape that is your father moves. A hand grabs you by the throat and slams you against the wall. You hear your shoulders pop before they break through the drywall.
I thought I told you to never come back here, boy. What the fuck are you doing back here?
Your father snarls. And the stench of alcohol permeates his breath. He, like your mother, and for some time you, is never far from a bottle. You open your mouth to speak, but additional pressure squeezes your throat too tight. A knee to your stomach forces all the air from your lungs as you fall silent. Your eyes burn and sting when your sunglasses are forcefully removed, and your vision grows even blurrier. Every light becomes a persistent flashbulb-like smear. Now your actions are not your own. You react as Dave did. You writhe wildly and try to bite the hand that holds you to the wall. Your efforts are rewarded with a slap in the face. Then, mercifully, you're dropped to the ground.
If you want to prove you're tough enough to take on the world, then show me. Show me what you learned.
You little bitch.
Your father growls. Metal scrapes against the tile floor. A blade spins toward you. When you reach for it, it slices into your left palm, digging deep into the skin. You swear you can see bone, but it's impossible to tell. Squinting at the wound seems to confirm the assessment. You can feel the damage regardless. The skin covering your hand no longer seems to want to stay in place. The freshly separated muscles that make your palm twitch and constrict strangely when you try to move your fingers. Your dominant hand is now useless. And lifting the sword with your right hand quickly reveals that this is most certainly a two-handed blade. You raise the weapon just in time to block a downward swing, and your wrist stains dangerously against the impact.
Get up!
Your father demands. And he hauls you to your feet before swiping at your legs. You don't, you can't dodge him. Instead, you feel a stinging, sharp pain across your shins as a honed edge rips through your skin. You swear you feel metal dragging over bone as you stagger and fall. Your wounded hand lands directly on a broken bottle, and shards of glass punch new holes in your palm. A particularly long piece rips directly through your flesh before jutting rudely out the other side, and you withdraw your hand with a hiss of pain.
What are you gonna do about it?
Taunts your father. A flash of light fills your vision. More pain overwhelms your senses. When you look down, you see a gaping wound running diagonally across your right forearm. Trying to pick up your sword pulls uncomfortably at the skin and flayed muscle, and you opt to abandon the weapon. It's too heavy, but you know you can't fight unarmed. Your right hand wraps around the neck of a discarded bottle as you scramble to your feet. You block the next swing with the improvised weapon, and the glass shatters. Your father's sword catches you in the backswing when you leap away, and you fall. Your head slams against the floor as your feet are yanked into the air. You can feel muscles and tendons straining. Flesh is shorn from the bone with unprecedented ease. The next blow rips cleanly through the ligaments of your left knee, and the limb dangles limply from its joint. Dave's voice fills your head, presumably narrating his final thoughts. I don't want to die. He thinks, please, not now, not now. I told Karkat I'd be back. I promised him I'd be back.
Get up,
your father demands. But your wounded leg refuses to comply. Your apparent disobedience seems to be the last straw. After a few sloppy, inebriated slashes and a firm kick in the face, he deals the penultimate blow. And your breath stops. When you look down, you see a blade jutting from your stomach. In all honesty, you had felt your life ending before now. This level of damage, all the blood you've lost, was never sustainable.
Why?
You wheeze. It's a question you certainly have, but your voice is not your own. You're speaking as Dave, and you continue to do so as you feel your life slipping through your fingers.
Why?
You repeat, more desperate than before.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to fuck it up, bro.
A metallic taste drips down the back of your throat.
Fuck. Fuck.
Your father's voice is drenched in fear. Somehow you get the sense that this was a crime of passion, an act driven by animalistic instinct. Part of him didn't want this, and enough of that bleeds through for him to panic.
Dave, I didn't mean to.
He stammers. Then he inhales. He rips the sword from your abdomen and lets it clatter to the floor. When he speaks again, his voice is hushed. His words flow forth in rapid succession as he mutters to himself,
I have to cover this up, little dude. Fuck.
Warmth begins to rush out of your body. You desperately grasp at your wound, but you know it's useless. When you try to take a deep breath, you feel something wet and slimy, some of your intestines, you assume, slapping through the gap and rubbing against your fingers. You have just enough energy and time to squeeze out one final plea.
Don't kill me, bro, please. I'll be good this time. I promise.
You know how this ends. But the answer you receive is still the last thing you expect. Metal, different, heavier and sturdier than before, scrapes against the floor. When your father speaks, his voice is wet and unrestrained. He's crying as he utters,
I'm sorry, Dave. This ain't how I wanted it to end between us.
You hear a sickening crunch. Your vision fails. For a few minutes, you can vaguely register what's happening to your body. You hear your father muttering to himself, talking about
covering this shit up
as he pulls on your engagement ring. You feel skin sloughing away from muscle as something pries the band upwards. There's surprisingly little blood. You can't tell if it's because of your failing, stuttering heart, or outright blood loss. Finally, as the ring is pressed against your intact palm, the world goes dark.
And in that darkness, you find yourself back in your own body and staring at Dave. You are once again Rose Lalonde, and he is your twin brother you only met and will now be forever parting with today. He's as he was before, dressed to impress and prepared for his engagement party. This time he sits on the invisible floor of the void. He spins his engagement ring around his finger as he looks up at you, eyes wide with shock.
Rose?
He asks. You don't get time to reply. He rushes to you, grabs you by the shoulders, and pulls you into a bone-crushing, desperate hug.
Please!
His voice cracks
out. I'm fucking dying! I'm sorry.
You say and you mean it.
I can't do anything about that.
Dave nestles his face into the crook of your neck. Instinct drives you to return his embrace as he continues, now just a breath away from sobbing.
Oh, I'm sorry. Don't cock it. I'd do anything to be there with him. I'd give the fucking world to be there tomorrow. I was genuinely so excited. I know.
You say, though, you don't truly know anything about your brother. For reasons beyond your comprehension, that fact eats at your soul. It twists a foreign knife in your stomach, digging it ever deeper. Dave doesn't point out the error. Instead, he hugs you just a bit tighter. His voice is softer now, barely a whisper of breath in your ear.
This is it. I need that. Fuck. Rose, I'm scared.
This time you say nothing. You can't think of anything that might comfort Dave. You don't know him well enough. That unpleasant, unknowable sensation returns and grips your chest. And Dave, seemingly aware that these are his last moments of anything approaching life in this world, lets you go. He steps back, and his form shimmers briefly.
I'm glad the bitch rooting around in my severely concussed brain was you.
His words hang in the air as he disappears into the abyss.
Winter 67, 2100. You know you shouldn't. You know it's a bad idea. And still, you go. You take an express plane to Houston, Texas, and use your credentials to get into the prison. That strange feeling, the thing you can't identify, still eats at your mind and soul. It taunts you as you step into a cold concrete visitation room and sit down across from a man who looks remarkably like Dave. He has the same nose, the same eyes, and the same indifferent attitude when he speaks. He has a much deeper version of Dave's voice, at least you assume. That Dave's mental projection is no once true to life. But like you, his skin is tanner. His graying hair is golden blonde. The stubble covering his chin, however, is completely gray. His face is worn away by stress and time, and healing bruises and cuts are the only outward signs of his crimes. So that's what you look like. He spits onto the table and narrows his eyes. What do you want?
It's simple, really. You say as you straddle the chair across the table from your father, Dirk Strider. I want to know why you killed Dave. A thick, rough hand rubs beneath a discolored nose. A hoarse snort of cold, indifferent laughter precedes his reply.
Why? He's dead. What does it matter?
You don't say that you're looking for answers. You don't say that you're trying to stifle the churning waves of a feeling you can't understand. Instead, you fabricate a not entirely untrue response.
The mayor of New Alternia wants to know.
And will it reduce my sentence, or is this merely a ruse? What will this prove?
He leans back and props his feet up on the table, ankles crossed, as he spits a wad of chewed tobacco onto the floor.
He's still dead, and I did it. What else is there to know?
I already asked my question, you say. When he leans in and sniffs your hair, you force yourself to stay still. His metal restraints rattle with every movement. After a few minutes, he shrugs and rolls his shoulders.
Fine. He pissed me off. That's all there is to it.
Somehow you stand your ground, you set your jaw and summon every ounce of authority you have.
If that were true, you would have killed him earlier.
True.
eyes that look much like your own, orange-tinted hazel surrounded by an odd, pinkish hue focus on a nondescript spot over your shoulder.
I didn't mean to kill him. I wanted to teach him a lesson. I've spent my entire miserable life teaching that bastard lessons. He never learns them either. Nah. Then great circles that drain endlessly, never learning, never changing. And I suppose marrying a mayor was the last straw.
Again, he leans in closer. You can smell the tobacco and the toilet booze on his breath as he says,
chasing power gets you nowhere, little girl. The sooner you learn, the sooner you survive.
You can't help but recoil from the advance. Two guards step forward and haul Dirk backwards. He lets forth a displeased growl as he settles into his seat.
Look, girl, I'm not your daddy. I never was. My job was to raise Dave, and I'd like to think I did my best. East didn't understand my methods. He was too soft, too squishy. The minute that kid stepped into the world, he caved like Circus Maximus, and Dino picked him up. I did. I took him in and fixed him up, and he thanked me by abandoning me.
You abused him, you state. Your words intentionally plain. Those scars he had, they weren't self-inflicted. You didn't just build him up. You abused him intentionally, repeatedly, and without remorse. A low, rumbling laugh, a sound with neither warmth nor joy, rises from Dirk's throat.
I gave up my career for that kid. I did everything the best I knew how, even if I can't remember half of it. If I fucked up, so be it. Everyone does. But everything I did was to help that ingrate thrive, and look how it ended up.
His stoicism falters, his voice breaks.
He's dead. And that's why I told him what happened. So hey, congrats to me for being right as usual.
That feeling in your chest twists and grows. There's disgust. There's anger. You barely know Dave. You met him for all of half an hour, and you can say the same for your father. They're both strangers, and you know nothing about them, yet somehow you feel an inexplicable sense of pity for them both. Neither of them lived the life they wanted, and they let it destroy them.
Look,
Dirk says, drawing your attention back to reality. His expression is somber. The bravado from before is gone. He breathes in before he continues.
I genuinely did not want to kill Dave. I know you won't believe me, but I loved him. In a sick, twisted way, I loved him.
When he looks at you, there's an inexplicable amount of sincerity in his eyes.
I never wanted to hurt him. I wanted to help him. To teach him how to handle the world.
You want to lash out? To spit every insult you know at your father. You want to verbally bury him, but you can't find it within yourself to do so. Instead, driven by a sudden surge of that horrifying, unidentifiable emotion, you stand and leave. You say nothing more to your father, and you plan never to see him again. Winter 68, 2100. The details of Dave Strider's funeral were published the day before the event, on Winter 67, in the Alternia Daily Herald. You weren't surprised to learn that it will be a private ceremony. Despite Carcass's popularity, there are still a few staunch bigots more than willing to crash his fiancée's funeral. You were, however, surprised to find a light gray permit card in your mailbox this morning. It's like any other event pass. Made of rigid, durable plastic, it's exactly the same size as a credit card. A wafer-thin screen on its front offers the rent-rate programmable message space, and you find yourself staring slack-jawed at the words flickering across the card. Admit 1. Mayoral Family Memorial Service. Winter 68. Year 2100. You've received plenty of these reusable passes. Normally they're for parties, conventions, and live shows. Despite being like any other rectangle of plastic, this one seems heavier. You feel as if you're holding a chunk of solid lead in your hand, and that strange feeling surges up the back of your throat like rancid bile. Your heartbeat turns into a nagging, steady thud against your skull. You shouldn't go. You've never before attended a funeral, especially not one for any of your clients. But he was your twin brother. Even if you only knew him for half an hour, As much as you hate to admit it, this case is different. Your attendance will be wholly self-serving, of course, and part of you cringes at your motives. The truth is the truth, though, and you can't change how you feel. You're looking for an escape. You need to assuage and dispel that nagging, stabbing sensation in your chest and put the thing you cannot name to sleep. The obituary asks for attendees to bring a copy of a cherished photo. After a bit too much thought, you carefully select a snapshot of your childhood cat, Jasper's. You throw on a plain black dress and hail an auto taxi to DeWitt's, the fanciest funeral home in the city. You spend the entire ride pondering what you'll see. After all, you've never been to a funeral. Despite your line of work, you've been lucky enough to avoid death in your personal life. Knowing nothing about your brother, you wonder if you'll be forced to endure some sort of religious spiel. Carcat's casual affiliation with the Cult of the Signless is a well-known fact, but that would have little bearing on Dave's choices. Fortunately, some of the tension releases when you arrive to find a no-religious-proselytizing-please sign on the main door. You present your pass to the security guard who scans the embedded code before waving you inside. Another guard guides you down the hall and into the main gathering space. The walls are adorned with real wood paneling and gold leaf. Faux candlelight flickers from the bronze chandeliers, and an eclectic mix of music pipes through the overhead speakers. A bright red urn rests upon a marble pedestal, and the large screen above it rotates through photos of Dave. Silently, from your spot at the back of the room, you watch the brother you never knew grow up. You see only a handful of childhood photos, and he sports a bruise, bandage, or splint in every single one. Once he hits his late teenage years, the photos become more frequent. You watch as he matures, as his jawline sharpens, and his chin sports occasional hints of scrubby stubble. He goes from being a lanky, awkward child to a lean, tall man. Perpetually pursed lips loosen, and he smiles more as he ages. As expected, you feel wildly out of place. Mourners stare at you with furrowed brows, likely wondering who the hell you are and why you're here. You try to draw inward to make yourself as small and unobtrusive as possible. This isn't your place, after all. You barely knew Dave. You expect that feeling to go away, but the fearsome thing you cannot name continues to pull at your heart and squeeze breath from your lungs as you approach the urn. It becomes an overwhelming force. You feel your eyes burning as tears threaten to spill over, and you forcibly distract yourself by staring at the oak table to the side. A folded sign describes its purpose. Leave a photo. Take a photo. One half of the surface is filled with random offerings, while the other half holds carefully organized stacks of printed postcards. There are five to choose from. A flower, a beer bottle, a taxidermied crow, an antique record player, and a red sneaker. After depositing your photo of Jasper's on the left, you pick up the crow. Dave's signature is printed on the back, and you could only assume he was an avid photographer. Curiosity then pulls you toward a man with black hair, tan skin, and rectangular glasses. When he notices you, he approaches and offers out his hand. He introduces himself as John, and you dully recognize his name. After wiping tears from his bright blue eyes, he forces a wavering, buck-toothed smile onto his face.
You must be Rose, right? You're that expert Carcat brought in.
You'll burst into tears if you say anything, so you respond with a tense nod. You can't cry here. Not at a client's funeral. John tugs at the starched collar of his light blue button down and breathes a weepy laugh.
Well, I thought I was coming back to New Alternia to be my best bro's best man, you know? I was so fucking happy for him. He'd finally figured himself out, and now...
He stares at the ground and bites his lip. Thick black eyebrows twitch as he hops to a different subject and asks,
was it fast at least? He didn't He wasn't suffering, was he? It wasn't a swift death, of course, you know that. Dave's final moments were a whirlwind of agony, fear, and heartache. But you have enough tact to soften the blow. You pat John on the shoulder and force yourself to smile as you reassure him. Yes, it was instant. John seems placated by your lie. He says nothing more, merely nodding appreciatively before emerging back into the crowd. Now you see Carcat. He's a few paces away, sobbing, as he stands beside a woman with long, straight hair and medium brown skin. His words come across as incoherent blubbering. It's strange to see him like this. You've only known him as an unflappable hard ass. The circumstances certainly justify his breakdown, but that knowledge only serves to further twist that nameless knife. The feeling squirms and thrashes in your gut before landing against your chest like a solid punch. You should leave, you don't belong here, but you can't bring yourself to move. You stand, frozen, and watch as the woman in front of Carcat wraps her arms around his midriff. He wouldn't want you so upset. She tries to comfort him, but she's just as heartbroken. This time when Carcat speaks, you could understand him.
I told him not to go. I told that stupid bastard not to go.
That feeling intensifies and overpowers your senses. It manifests as a physical ache in your chest, and you stumble through the crowd to escape. You press yourself against the far wall and try to regain your composure. Several minutes of deep breathing turn the sensation of someone trying to rip out your heart into a dull, persistent ache. And for a minute, you think you see him. He's standing in the middle of the crowd, hands firmly buried in the pockets of his gaudy red suit and staring into your soul. When you blink, he's gone. When you turn to your left, you see a display of photo cards, each glossy, wallet-sized printout shows Dave laughing at some unknown joke with Carcat. They're carefree and relaxed. A far cry from what you've seen over the past few days, you pick one up and flip it over.
David Ellison Strider, 2065 through 2100. I'll be real fucking pissed if there ain't big tits and good dick in the afterlife.
You smile weakly at the joke and pocket the item before slipping away from the venue. That horrible feeling has yet to subside. In fact, it seems to have grown more intense.
Winter 71, 2100. With just about 3 more weeks remaining in the year, you find yourself in the local cemetery. It's not surprising to see that Dave's grave has already been fully furnished and decorated. A solid concrete slab supports a lavish black granite obelisk. There's a blank space at the top, presumably left for Carcat's name. Then there's gold-filled text.
David E. Strider, 2065 through 2100. Friend and husband, loving you was my greatest joy. Losing you is my greatest grief.
Mounted beneath the text and encased in a solid, built-in frame is a photo. Dave, wearing a smile that spans across his entire face, has his arm thrown over his fiancée's shoulder. Beneath your fingers, the granite is only slightly colder than the air around you. According to the forecast, it should snow tomorrow. You find yourself wondering if your brother, a man you knew nothing about until under a week ago, liked snow. You wonder if he too liked to scoop up a handful of every snowfall and nibble on it as he wandered through the fresh blanket of white. Did he cry when he chopped onions like your mother? Did he love the smell of springtime's fresh buttercups like you? That unknown feeling, the beast that has plagued you and driven you mad for the past 7 days, grows stronger. It strangles your mind and squeezes the air from your lungs. Your eyes sting, and it doesn't take long for you to realize you're crying. Oh. A gruff, hoarse voice interrupts your soul. Karkat, a wide-shouldered behemoth of a troll, stands several yards away. A rosy hue shines dully beneath his otherwise gray cheeks and at the tip of his nose. A massive bouquet of flowers is clutched to his chest, and a gust of wind tugs at the bottom of his black overcoat as he clears his throat and gathers his thoughts. For the past 2 years, you've known him as the city's loud-mouthed, quick-witted mayor. He easily eviscerates his opponents with streams of virulent, factual information. Today, beneath an overcast sky, he's little more than the heartbroken remnant of a relationship that will never be. When he speaks, his voice is strangely quiet. I'm sorry, I didn't realize anyone was visiting. No, I was just leaving, you lie, wiping at your face with the sleeve of your jacket. Karkat tilts his head to the side. A few strands of his wiry hair fly about in the breeze. You don't have to leave, he says as he pulls a sample-sized bottle of high-end apple cider from his inner pocket. Dave would be happy as a fucking oink beast and mod if he saw a little crowd at his grave. He would, you ask, only half interested. Karkat nods and approaches slowly. When he meets no resistance, he closes the last few feet in two long strides. The bottle of alcohol is set on the edge of the obelisk's platform, and the flowers are carefully arranged in the awaiting bronze vase. A thought, something you've been violently suppressing for the past few days, rises to the forefront of your mind. The words in your head leave your mouth like 10-ton stones, and you're somewhat surprised that they don't leave indents in the snow. He said to tell you that he loves you, and that he's sorry. A sad smile tugs at Karkat's lips, revealing flashes of pointed teeth that aren't quite as sharp as you'd expect. His black claws, carefully trimmed and filed down, extend and retract a few times from his chest as a buzzing, purr-like rumble. Of course, he eventually says. That nook-chafing bastard would use his last words to apologize for dying. He sits on the ground by the obelisk and pulls two pale apples from the same pocket as before. One gets placed by the bottle of cider, and he quietly bites into the second. Finally, as the horrifying feeling you can't quite explain reaches its apex, you recognize its name. Grief. You're grieving a brother you never knew. A connection you had just moments to feel before it slipped into the abyss of entropy. You're mourning a man who, by all accounts, would have been your best friend. And finally, mercifully, the fear that has dragged you by the throat through the past week dissipates into nothingness. You use your foot to brush away some dirt and to sit beside Karkat. What was he like? You ask. Tell me about my twin brother.
The Homestuck Fan Author Coalition is a place for authors to write, brainstorm, discuss, and collaborate. Link available in description. The music is Encephalon Dave by Sam Gabriel. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which can be found at samgabrielvo.com. And there you can find links to other stories that I've done, my Discord server, and ways to support what I do. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.